Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Transitions into new roles are the crucibles in which leaders get their toughest tests, and they're the defining factor in professional careers today. Yet far too often, leaders fail to transition effectively into new roles. The resulting costs are high for your career and the organization. In the new book, Your Next Move, leadership transition guru Michael Watkins shows leaders how to survive and thrive in all the major transitions they face. With real-life examples and case studies, he illustrates the defining hurdles associated with each type of transition. Michael D. Watkins is co-founder of Genesis Advisors, a Newton Mass-based leadership development firm specializing in transition acceleration programs and coaching. Michael, well, let's go right to the heart of the matter. Let's start off by talking about the research you did for this book.
It's important to understand how this book fits with the first 90 days. When I was doing the research for the first 90 days, I was trying to look at what are the general principles that help people make transitions at all levels, whether you're a frontline supervisor or the president of the United States. My hypothesis was there were certain underlying general principles that applied. And the first 90 days was really a distillation of that, the result of a whole series of interviews I did. Following the publication of that book, I began to get lots of questions of the form. I am in this particular position with this particular situation. How do I apply these principles? And I would smile, and sometimes I would think I have absolutely no idea whatsoever, and other times I'd have thoughts to offer. But it was really getting a whole series of questions like that that got me thinking about the fact that leaders do go through common sets of transitions over the course of their career, and that we can say pretty coherent things about those distinct types of transitions. So the book, Your Next Move, is really about trying to dig deeper into those classic kinds of transitions that leaders go through.
Can you explain?
Sure. The research really had two stages. One was looking at a lot of surveying that I had done of leaders in our transition programs over time. I'd asked them questions about what kinds of transitions have you gone through and how frequently have you gone through them? What did you find the most challenging? Did you find this more challenging than that? Out of that, I tried to distill a set of common core transitions people tended to go through once or more during their careers, and I converged on 8. Mm-hmm. The research from there went into interview research, talking to people that had gone through those kinds of transitions, trying to distill what really made those hard, what was some advice that might help, and that was really the genesis of the book.
I would think, Michael, given the economy right now, there are many people who would be interested in this type of book because their careers are in transition.
I think it is really timely. Lots of people are thinking about their next move because there's so much turmoil going on in organizations. But also, I think there's a tremendous amount of pent-up demand for people to move on to new roles once the economy begins to free up a little bit more. We're going to just see a big wave of people making transitions, assuming the economy continues to improve. And so I think the timing for the book is excellent.
You mentioned that the book focuses on 8 situations. Can you talk about that?
The 8 are being promoted to a higher level, which leaders experience 6, 7, 8 times typically in their careers. Leading former peers, which is a specialized version of the promotion transition, but one that's really fraught with interpersonal peril. Mm. What I call the corporate diplomacy challenge, which is moving from a position where you've had a lot of authority to suddenly having no authority whatsoever, needing to build alliances and influence people very differently. Mm-hmm. Joining a new company, the onboarding challenge of dealing with a new culture and a new set of politics. Making an international move, which is another one that presents some pretty unique challenges and that many will experience. And then the last 3 really have to do with different kinds of business situations that people would encounter, turning around something that's in deep trouble, proactively changing something that's beginning to get into trouble, and then dealing with a complex mix of organizations in different states.
All right. You mentioned moving up to a position of greater authority. I think one of the problems is lack of training for a person to assume that responsibility.
Correct. There's a lot of common core challenges when you get promoted. And for example, you need to delegate differently than you did in the past. You need to communicate differently because you're at a greater distance from the front lines. And that happens each time you're promoted. But I think what you're getting at is the competencies can also shift pretty dramatically as you rise up through the organization. And what makes sense when you're a frontline supervisor is not going to make sense from a managerial skill point of view when you get to being a general manager. And so partially it's about those competency shifts that are really so crucial.
Right, right. In your book, you focus on the specific skills, abilities, and knowledge. You write about the importance of early wins.
I firmly believe, and the research backs me up, that getting early wins is centrally important for new leaders coming into new roles, because you've got to get traction, you've got to create momentum. The way you do that is by showing some early victories, but that comes with a big set of caveats that says what you do to get early wins, what they are, and how you go about getting them really depends on the situation you find yourself in.
For instance,
if you're in a turnaround situation, you're going to be going for rapid diagnosis, getting to the core of what the problem is, putting in place a new strategy, tearing down the organization, pruning a lot of dead limbs quickly, and that's where early wins are going to come from. If you're in a more proactive change situation, storm clouds are on the horizon, but lots of people still may be in denial about the need for things to happen. The early wins may be about raising awareness of the need for change. So yes, early wins, but also yes, you need to be thoughtful. And you need to get them in a way that people acknowledge as legitimate.
Of course.
You could get an early win, but there are cultures where if you mow down a whole lot of people in the process, that's not going to be perceived as too positive.
Michael, in the book, you talk about dealing with problems and the ability to assess the state of affairs. Could you go deeper on these for us?
Absolutely. I call it the STARS Portfolio Challenge, and STARS stands for the model that I developed.
Okay.
Startup, turnaround, accelerated growth, realignment, sustaining success. The idea here is different parts of your organization may be in different states. So step one is getting in and doing the diagnosis and identifying in what state are different pieces. Maybe this part of the organization is just getting off the ground. That's a startup. Another part may be ramping up. That's accelerating growth. There may be a turnaround piece going on. There may be a realignment piece going on. And the quicker you can get clear and you can help your team get clear on what the different states of the pieces are, the more quickly everyone can align against what needs to happen. It also goes back to your point about getting early wins. You can then figure out, how am I going to get early wins differently in those different pieces? In addition, it may have some big impacts for what you focus on initially. If you've got part of your business that's in turnaround, maybe you want to focus a disproportionate amount of energy on beginning to turn that baby around, because that buys you credibility to go on and do other things in other parts of the business.
Okay. Could you take two or three of those eight situations and explain some of the problems individuals would experience and how to address them?
Yes. I'll say a little bit more about the Leading Former Peers Challenge. There's a couple of common things that people face. And this, by the way, brings up a point that I like to emphasize, which is if I'm working with a group of managers that have, let's say, 5 to 10 years of experience, virtually every one of them will experience at some point leading former peers. Yet every one of them has had to learn how to do that by stumbling around in the dark, knocking their nose against doors. It makes no sense for people to have to learn to make transitions all on their own, when we can really distill these common lessons.
Exactly.
When you talk to people who have led former peers successfully, what they'll tell you is you need to be very deft in how you establish your authority. You're leading people who think they know you, who have not been under your authority previously, and now you've got to establish your authority. You can fall off either end of a spectrum. On one end, you can continue to function like a peer, like a super peer, and not really lead those people. On the other hand, you can get too much in touch with your inner authoritarian, the Alexander Haig in all of us that says we are in command,
right,
and begin to issue edicts. Either way, you're falling off the wagon here. I think the key is to be in the middle, to deftly establish your authority.
What can they do?
There's a few techniques that help to do that. One is biasing yourself a bit more towards what I think of as consultant decide decision making, which is take lots of advice from people, but have people get comfortable with the fact that you're eventually going to make the call. Always stress that your criteria are what's good for the business. It's not personal. It's not about scores that are going to be settled. It's really you making judgments about what's good for the business as a whole.
Yeah.
The other piece of this one is, how do you deal with disappointed competitors who are now still working for you? It's virtually inevitable that someone on your team is going to think that they should have had the job and they didn't get it. The point is, how do you identify and think about how to re-enlist good people who may be very disappointed in what's happened, who may be very concerned that their careers are over, who may be very inclined either to resist what you're doing subtly and subconsciously, or be going to look for some other job? If you really want to retain those good people, how do you re-enlist them? What do you do with the folks that really aren't going to be able to work with you in the end, that really can't stand the fact that you are now their boss? And how do you make sure that you don't wait too long and let them really undermine what you're doing, because they can be a very toxic influence?
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true.
One other is the onboarding challenge. Mm-hmm. The key here is you're coming into a new culture and a new political system. What the research very consistently shows is people coming in from the outside don't fail because they're not good managers, and they don't fail because they're not knowledgeable about the business issues or don't have the right technical competencies. It's virtually always about either culture or politics or the mix of the two. It's especially risky for people who have lived inside one organization for a long time and haven't experienced multiple organizational cultures, and then they go into another culture and they're completely blindsided by just how different it can be.
Right.
The key here is gaining some understanding of what organizational culture is. How do you diagnose a culture? How do you adjust yourself and your style to live within the culture? The metaphor I use is culture is like the human immune system. If you do the wrong things, if you create too much irritation in the organization, it will attack and destroy you. The key is to not let that happen.
Is there some way to know if your style would fit the culture of a company before you join that company?
Absolutely. There's two components to that. One is being self-aware about what your style is, which means getting some basic work done on leadership assessment, style, and 360s so that you understand something about how you lead. Then the second thing is, as you're interviewing, ask questions about the culture. Don't necessarily believe everything you hear, because people will tend to be positive. They'll talk more about the culture they wish they had than the culture they actually have. Find people who used to work with the organization and maybe a little bit more objective about what it takes to be successful. But I think you're hitting a really key point, which is you don't want to set yourself up to fail by taking yourself into a culture that's just the antithesis of how you lead. You're an empowerment-oriented leader, and congratulations, you've joined the ultimate command and control organization. This is not likely to be a happy marriage.
Michael, given the current economy and all the movement that's occurring in corporations, did your research involve an individual who found himself or herself supervising people that formerly were their supervisor?
Fortunately, it's a relatively rare occurrence, but it happens. And when it happens, it's rarely a happy experience, because it's one thing to lead people who were formerly your peers, where there was that initial level and then you're elevated a bit. That inversion of authority is really terrible.
Oh, yeah.
It's the rare person who can stand that they used to be your boss and now you're their boss. It's more commonly the fact that they can't deal with it than that you can't deal with it. It's relatively easy for you. You're the winner, but it's very easy for them to perceive themselves as being a big loser. The hit that that involves to the ego is really, really high. I haven't seen examples where this has ended happily. And if you assess that it's not going to end up happily, the best thing you can do is help that person find some place where they can feel better about what they're doing and how they're doing. Mm-hmm. There may need to be a transition period, because it may be crucial that their skills be there and present in the organization for a while. And I suppose it's theoretically possible that you could make that adjustment happen because that person possesses extraordinary maturity, or realize they weren't really at the right level and are happy to be back doing something that's simpler. And if those two things are true, I can imagine it happening. But if they had all that self-awareness and capability, they probably wouldn't be in this position in the first place.
Now, let's say somebody has relocated, or you have a new employee who really doesn't understand the culture that well. As a leader, what should you be doing to help the absorption of the person into the firm?
There's a couple of ways we can look at that. One is, what can you as an individual boss do to help somebody join the company? And the answer is lots. Biggest thing being making yourself available and having time to talk to someone about the culture of the organization, being very clear about what your expectations are, helping them understand what your working style is really all about. One simple thing I recommend bosses do when they've hired someone into a new role, whether it's internal or external, is put together a top 10 list of the people the new hire should get connected to. Tell them why they should be meeting those people, and send emails out to those people saying, here's why I think it's important for you to meet with that person.
Uh-huh.
That begins to knit together the political connection. I think the other thing I'd do is help them find someone who's thoughtful about the culture, who can act as a cultural interpreter they can go to for advice, even if it's not you. It could be an HR person, could be a peer, but someone that can give them perspective about the working culture of the organization.
Exactly.
I think, though, there's also a bigger question, which is, what can the organization do? I see lots of companies creating what I think of as specialized transition systems. So let's create an onboarding system. Onboarding is just one kind of transition that's going on in your organization. And you don't need multiple different kinds of transition systems because they all rest on a common core of principles that you can use to help people get on board. It's also often highly productive to mix people who are onboarding with people who've been promoted to the same level internally because you can get so much productive interchange. So I'm a big advocate of companies building a system that really helps everyone making significant transitions in the organization based on one common framework, one common language, one set of tools customized for the particular kinds of transitions that people face.
Hmm. Very interesting. I would think a company that has gone through a recession should accelerate the learning curve and get the organization back to its usual state.
Anytime you're going through any kind of major restructuring or acquisition integration, there's a huge amount of transition that's going on in the organization. So very similar ideas can be applied to speed up everybody. Once you've got the new strategy and the new structure and the new staffing, often organizations fall down in terms of the actual implementation phase. They're not particularly good at then helping everyone get up to speed and knitting together the organization. So the organization may stumble around for a while before that happens. But the other thought that comes off what you're saying is organizations are probably going to have to swap from a downsizing mode to a hiring mode, assuming all goes well. And how dramatic that hiring will be remains to be seen. They've got to be very concerned about their high potential talent and the kind of damage that's been done during the recession. And this is a product partially of how well they actually manage the downsizing process. If they did a bad job of it, then they've got lots of people that are probably just dying to leave and find that better opportunity. So they're very much at risk of losing a lot of high potential talent. And that means some rapid damage control work if you're going to really avoid a big exodus when other companies start looking at your talent pool and wanting to pluck out those high performers.
We'd like to thank our guest today, Michael Watkins, author of the new book, Your Next Move. Mike, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
With only an internet connection and a browser, you can tap into AMA's world-class training. The American Management Association is bringing live instructor-led training right to your desktop. AMA's new virtual seminar offering features a live virtual format that is highly interactive and very user-friendly. It's taught by the same expert, world-class faculty that run our classroom sessions, and the high-quality content has been specially engineered to run in an online format. You get real-time online interaction with your course leader and your fellow attendees. You will receive a USB headset so that you can not only listen but talk to your classmates and your instructor. So take advantage of these offerings, enhance your career journey by building your skills, and you don't have to take any time away from the office. For more information about AMA's virtual seminar offering, visit our website at www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.